Say good morning to each one. Welcome to our service. Smaller crowd, but it still is nervous on this side. But trust we'll get through. Our text this morning comes from John chapter 3, the second half of John. In the first half of John chapter 3 there, we looked at the account. We had the account of Nicodemus coming to Jesus, looking for answers. I believe Nicodemus was hurting inside. And I say that because why else would he risk his position with the ruling class? Why else would he risk his standing with the other Pharisees around him who were not necessarily part of the ruling class, but were looking on, possibly even risk his life just to meet Jesus? And then Jesus' response to this need that Nicodemus had. Isn't it interesting, out of all the people, and I can't help but just think about this, isn't it interesting, out of all the people that Jesus could have shared this profound truth with, it was with a man who had everything. And I'm talking about the profound truths of, you know, John chapter 3, about the need to be born again, and about John and verse 16, the verse that we all know by memory, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." Out of all the people, all the various people in different positions of accepting God or rejecting God and everything in between, it was with a man who had everything. Money, power, prestige, he even had religion. It wasn't with a bum on the street or a man who was steeped in sin, or at least not as society would have viewed him being steeped in sin. It was with a man who thought that because of who he was and what he had, everything should be okay in his heart. But he realized it wasn't. And Jesus told him that all that he had, all that he thought he was in vain unless he was born again. Nothing that he had or claimed in this life would save him from the condemnation that awaited him except Jesus Christ. Moving then to our text, verse 22 follows this account with Nicodemus, verse 22 through 36. I want to read that at this time. Before I read that, the title of the message is pretty basic here, "The Last Testimony of John." You want to say John the Baptist, okay, but I shortened it to "The Last Testimony of John." The last testimony that we have account of John the Baptist giving publicly. Let's read, I'm going to read John chapter 3, verse 22 through the end of the chapter. "After these things, Jesus and his disciples came into the land of Judea, and there he remained with them and baptized. Now John also was baptizing in Annon near Salem, because there was much water there. And they came and were baptized, for John had not yet been thrown into prison. Then there arose a dispute between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purification. And they came to John and said to him, 'Rabbi, he who was with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing, and all are coming to him.' John answered and said, 'A man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease. He who comes from above is above all. He who is of the earth is earthly and speaks of the earth. He who comes from heaven is above all. And what he has seen and heard, that he testifies, and no one receives his testimony. He who has received his testimony has certified that God is true. For he whom God has sent speaks the words of God, for God does not give the Spirit by measure. The Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand. He who believes in the Son has everlasting life, and he who does not believe the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides in him." Jumping right into the verses here, verse 22, we see the phrase, "after these things." I would say the two words, "these things," is plural. If John the Apostle was just referencing the account of Nicodemus, it would have been singular. So that would appear that John is linking the events in chapter 2, maybe even some of the events in chapter 1 with the events in chapter 3, in that they happened close together. And that would sort of go against what some people say, that the cleansing of the temple that is mentioned in John 2 actually happened at the end of Jesus' ministry. For what it's worth, I'm not sure that it's a big deal, but it's just something that I thought about, that I don't believe John would have said these things if he was just referencing after this account with Nicodemus. I would seem that he's linking more, possibly the first everything that happened in the book of John to this point. But be that as it is, we don't know for sure, but that's just something that I was thinking about. But anyhow, Jesus and his disciples traveled to Judea, which was it was just southwest of Jerusalem. We don't know how far into Judea he went. It would appear that it was just a short journey. And they stayed there a while, and they were baptizing the crowds of people. In verse 23, we see that John the Baptist and his disciples were about approximately 55 to 60 miles northeast of this location. They were also baptizing people that came to their town, the little town called Annon, A-E-N-O-N. I guess I'm saying that right. But a couple of things of interest here. The first thing I noticed, Jesus himself was not baptizing the people. And we see that if we jump to chapter 4, verse 2, it says it very plainly that Jesus himself did not baptize, but his disciples. Baptizing was reserved for the disciples of Jesus, and I believe that it still is today. It would seem that Jesus is beginning to establish his church here. He would be the head. The others, or we could say his disciples, which would include us as well, were to do the work. Jesus was teaching. His disciples were baptizing. Again, much like the church functions today. While Jesus isn't here in person to teach, it's still his word that convicts men of sin and convinces them of the need to be born again. And we have to be convinced of that. It's not a preacher, not a teacher who can convict you of sin. It is the word of Jesus Christ that does that convicting. It does that convincing. It's God alone through the person Jesus Christ that draws all men to himself. And when men elevate their status or their value to the point that it becomes they who are changing lives, the change will not last. Men play to emotions. Jesus changes. Jesus touches hearts. Second item of interest here is John the Baptist was still active in kingdom work. Now, just imagine that you're in John's situation here. Here comes Jesus, the promised Messiah. This was John's responsibility. This was his calling to announce the coming of the Messiah, to get people to be aware and to notice and to focus on him when he comes. This is the one everyone was waiting for. He's finally here. Wouldn't it be easy for John to feel like that he couldn't hold a candle to Jesus and Jesus' ministry and Jesus' teaching? I mean, after all, John said that he wasn't even worthy to loosen Jesus' sandal strap. John could have said, "I'm a nobody compared to Jesus. I can't embarrass myself. People will come, will try to compare me, or maybe even get confused. So I'll just quietly back off the scene and just be a nobody over here." But that wasn't John the Baptist, was it? Third thing to note here, this really, really struck me, is the simplicity of finding God's will. Look at verse 23. John was baptizing near Salem. Why? Because he had divine inspiration from God? Because God miraculously led him to this place? Or was there a string of extraordinary events that could have only happened, been designed by God to draw him to this place? No, because there was a lot of water there. But you know, it's easy for us when we begin to consider the mind of God, the workings of God, and we feel that they're way up here, and they are, and we're way down here. But we feel that... We feel that we can't possibly, because of that, because God is so much greater than we are, that we can't possibly be able to figure out what he wants, or way too often we make it more difficult to find God's will. When all God really wants from us is willing obedience to what we already know. We talked about that this morning in Sunday school. What faith is how do we show God that we love him? By willing obedience to what we already know, to his word. And I don't mean to discourage you from studying the Bible or to trying to figure out how God works and understand God. I believe we all should desire a deeper knowledge of God, a deeper relationship, to invest more and to research more and to try to figure out what we can as much as God gives ability. But in that desiring, in that research, let's trust Him to enlighten our understanding of His will and His word as He sees best. Maybe some of the things that we don't fully understand, maybe we don't need to understand them right now. Maybe He will reveal them after we have followed Him in simple, childlike faith. It's easier said than done many times, isn't it? We want to know. We want to get to the bottom. We want to get to the root. I want to figure it out. But sometimes God wants us just to follow Him in simple, childlike faith. Go baptize where the water is. The kingdom of heaven reaches down and touches men where they are. You know, again, sometimes we get that confused. We think that we had to move to a certain plateau or a certain location or a certain, we have to be part of a certain calling before God. The truth is the kingdom of heaven reaches us, touches us, our lives, where we are, where God placed us. Verse 25, there arose a dispute. The King James Version says there was a question. And this is the same word, the Greek word that's used in 2 Timothy chapter 2. If we go back to that, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 23. But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. The Greek dictionary says this about the word question, or the word dispute here, as used in John 3 and also in 2 Timothy. In the New Testament, it indicates an exchange of words rather than a true search. In other words, here in John and also in 2 Timothy and other places possibly in the New Testament, for whatever reason, there really isn't a genuine search for the truth going on. It could be that people are simply at odds with each other, so they put out little barbs, they put out little statements that they know will generate sort of like a bone with the juicy meat on it into a pack of dogs, or a pen of dogs, and everybody knows what's going to happen. Instead of really genuinely searching for the truth. Verse 25 also says that the dispute was about purification. Now, we're not told what all this dispute involved, but to the extent of it, but based on the following verses, it would seem that baptism was involved in this disputing. But in verse 26, whether the problem was in verse 26 here was the center of this dispute or whether it came to light because of the dispute, we don't really know. In other words, they could have been, Jews and the disciples could have been discussing this idea of baptism, and the Jews could have possibly said something like, well, this baptism that Jesus is doing, or, you know, this baptism isn't enough. We need to go through a whole ritual to be pure. And then Jesus or John's disciples could have said, well, Jesus is his disciples, they're baptizing, and that's all they're doing. And then, you know, possibly the Jews could have said, yeah, how about this man, Jesus? He's baptizing a whole lot more people than you guys are. I don't know that, we don't know that necessarily that it came about that way, but it could have happened that way. Way back in the very infancy of the church, there were disputings among men. People were looking outward instead of looking upward. You know, that never benefits the church. That never benefits individuals in the church. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12, but they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise. That must be a really difficult verse for us to get through our heads. Guilty, I'm guilty. I'm not having any condemnation here, just helping us understand what the scriptures say. We're probably always guilty at some point or more. I mean, just, you know, it's easy to do. It's easy to be led down that path to look outward and, well, he's doing this, she's doing this, instead of looking upward and focusing on what God wants for me to do and helping me to be faithful in that. Many more times that would be more effective in helping those around us then to also see God's will and to act accordingly. Pettiness, bickering, and jealousy. There's a story here about a pastor. He says this: recently I retired, and last Sunday I was in the congregation at our new church. The worship service started, and I was singing heartfelt worship to the Lord. He was really getting into the service. Then I noticed two older men in the aisle about 20 feet from me. They were still talking. I instantly thought, come on, guys, talk time is over. You're going to be disturbing the people around you. Then this second thought flashed in my mind: you know nothing about these men. I'm sure that second thought was from the Lord. About a minute later, I looked in their direction again. They had stopped talking, and the man who was still there was wiping away tears. I was ashamed and asked God to help that hurting man with his problems. Let me ask you, how long has it been since you jumped to conclusions? How long has it been since you got riled up about something that really didn't matter in the long run? Things like petty bickering and jealousy can do great damage to God's church, and the devil will do anything he can to divide and distract God's people. And I underlined the word distract because a lot of times we get the concept of dividing. We get the idea that there's divisions and things come between us. But what about the idea of distracting? Possibly the devil's saying, let's keep God's people focused over here on something other than the real point, which is following God and bringing honor to God and working together so that God does receive honor and glory. Instead, we're distracted from that. That distraction, the word distraction, really, really stood out to me. Gossip is the bellows that fans the flames of bickerings and disputings. Probably not many of us here have seen, other than maybe we went to Colonial Williamsburg and watched the bellows in action, but it was a big, to put it simple, it was a big fan that blew air in on the fire and kept it hot, made it hotter. And you know, I think gossip a lot of times is like that. It fans the flames of disputings and murmurings and complainings and jealousy and whatever else you want to throw in there. Gossip looks outward. It sees something it does not or does like in someone else and spreads it around. But you know, when we're attacking others, when we're attacking and demeaning someone else's character or personality traits, we're really attacking God for making them that way. Man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. Verse 27. Verse 28, John reminded his disciples that they had heard him testify that Jesus was greater than he was. We again see the humility of John the Baptist. I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. And now again, we mentioned multiple times already in studying through, looking at the book of John here, but it's already been brought out many times that John could have been a proud person, but instead he chose to humble himself. It would have been easy for John to exalt himself above the position that he should have been. People today do it on far less grounds than what John the Baptist would have had. John was prophesied about in the Old Testament, and even Jesus himself said that John, there was no greater, or that he was the greatest of all the apostles. But John realized that his value was based on what God was doing in his life, not what others thought about him, not even what he thought about himself. But for the grace of God, where would you be, where would I be, if it wasn't for the grace of God? Verse 29 is an interesting verse. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. Now, come across an account or an article that said this: wedding custom in John's day dictated it was the best man, the friend of the bridegroom, who invited guests to the wedding, made preparations for the wedding, and finally, upon completion of the wedding, escorted the bride and groom to the bridal chamber. Thus, it was the voice of the bridegroom signaling that everything was okay within the chamber that brought joy to the heart of the best man. Different way of preparing a wedding, isn't it? But the article goes on to say then, the writer goes on to say this, do you know when joy is fulfilled? It's not when we get something from the Lord or do something for the Lord, but when we hear the voice of the Lord. If you're expecting your joy to be fulfilled through finding a husband, a faster car, a better job, you're headed for disaster. If you're caught up in thinking, if I could move to this place, like Florida, if I could teach that Bible study or sing with the other worship team, if I could just be effective here or useful there, then I will find joy. If you're caught up in thinking that, you're headed for disappointment and despair. But if you spend time with the Lord, reading His Word, and simply listening for His voice, your joy will be fulfilled. I don't know what all John meant here when he said, therefore this joy of mine is fulfilled, but I believe it had to do with the next verse. He must increase, but I must decrease. John's mission was simple. It was simple to point people to Christ. And he humbled himself before God and did his very best to teach people to repent and to become disciples of Jesus. To see larger numbers of people going to Jesus to be baptized than were coming to him to be baptized would have been most fulfilling indeed, wouldn't it? His mission on earth had been accomplished. People were finding Jesus. What greater joy could there be than to first hear the voice of Jesus, to act accordingly, sharing with what we've heard and experienced in our hearts, and then to see those that we're teaching bear fruit in their lives for Jesus, for the kingdom of heaven. What greater joy can there be? Verse 31. John the Baptist went on to explain then in greater detail why Jesus is greater than he himself, or anyone else for that matter. He who comes from above is above all. He who is of the earth is earthly and speaks of the earth. He who comes from heaven is above all. You know, we can go back to John chapter 1. We see that Jesus was at the beginning of creation. He was with God. Now the creator of the world has come from God. And although he was a man, Jesus was and is much different than any other person. He is above all in nature, in rank, and in authority. Hebrews 1, the first two verses, says Jesus is superior to the prophets. And then we look at verses 4 through 14 of Hebrews 1, tells us that Christ is superior to the angels and is over all the universe. Go back to Ephesians chapter 1. Breaking in verse 19, the end of 19, according to the working of his mighty power, which he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above principality and power and might and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in that which is to come. And he put all things under his feet and gave him to be head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. Verse 32 and 33, back to our text in John chapter 3. Jesus is speaking from firsthand experience. Verse 32, and what he has seen and heard, that he testifies. Jesus is speaking from firsthand experience, not what someone told him. He is the authority. And you know, you think about it, we could go back through the Old Testament, and every one of the experiences that are accounted there, Jesus was right there beside the Father, noticing and witnessing what was happening in those situations, getting the account firsthand. Think of Abraham when he was asked by God to sacrifice his son. Jesus was there with God, watching and observing Abraham and his response. Same thing with Joseph when he was thrown into the pit and later thrown into prison. Jesus was there with God, observing the situation firsthand. Moses, when Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, Jesus was there. Daniel, when he was thrown into the den of lions, Jesus was there watching. And the three Hebrews, when they were thrown into the fire, he was actually in the fire with them. And we could go on and recount other accounts in the Old Testament. But this recognition of who Jesus was and who John was, I believe was why John the Baptist was a great prophet, why he was a great disciple of Jesus Christ. How could John not have been humbled by the recognition of who Jesus was? And how can we not be humbled by that same recognition? I believe this is also why John's disciples were struggling so, why they were failing to see Jesus for who he really was. They were elevating themselves instead of elevating who really deserved to be elevated, and that was Jesus. In closing then, in verse 35 and 36, what was John the Baptist's last testimony? The Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand. Notice verse 36, he who believes in the Son has everlasting life, and he who does not believe in the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides in him. I believe that verse 36 summarizes what John believed about Jesus and why he had such a passion to see others, for others to see Jesus and to become disciples of Jesus. He who believes in the Son has everlasting life. He who does not believe, we could say, will be like Nicodemus. They will look to find fulfillment in themselves and things, and they will fill their lives with as many things as they can from the world to try to appease themselves. Jesus said these things will eventually rust and corrupt and fade away. You know, I can think of a man who gets into his truck and just spends countless hours on polishing and washing and detailing his truck. Not saying there's anything wrong with that in and of itself, but then when you look at how the man relates to his two sons, he has no relationship. The sons are fearful when they're around him because it's just constant railing and bashing and why'd you do this with your car? Why'd you do that? What, didn't you know? How could you not have known? His sons are going to live forever. The truck will be a pile of rust and rubble someday, polished or unpolished. We notice in the book of Ephesians that seeing and accepting Jesus for who he is makes living out what he asks us to live, the way he asks us to live, much less cumbersome and much less burdensome. And you know, I believe John the Baptist was a real life example of that. Once he recognized who Jesus was, who he was, and where he fit into the spectrum, it made living and doing what Jesus asked him so much easier to do. May the grace of God humble us before God and his Son Jesus Christ so that we too can find living in his will a joy and delight. Let's kneel for prayer.